From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Maybe it's just Southern chic, or maybe the South really is rising again. After all, the last three presidents hail from below the Mason-Dixon line, and various Southern passions, from NASCAR to country music, have swept the country. But why do some Yankees still regard Southern society as just a matter of black and white?
Come South and everybody say, oh yeah, that's where they have the black folks and white folks. Well, we also have Irish and Italian and Jewish. And when they came to the South, they didn't leave their cultural selves behind.
This hour, the children of Dixie. First, a quirky tour of a few Southern pastimes, from squirrel hunting and cockfighting to the roly-holers of Kentucky and Tennessee. Journalist Burkhard Bilger explores these traditions in Noodling for Flatheads. As he told Steve Paulson, his book's title refers to the practice of snaring catfish barehanded.
Noodling is this technique that people have been using for hundreds of years, where in the springtime you walk along a riverbank and the catfish are nesting there and protecting their eggs, and a noodler will just stick his arm into holes that seem likely and start wiggling his fingers, and if there's a big catfish inside, he'll basically bite your fingers. The noodler then will jam his arm down the fish's throat and basically spear him on his forearm and pull him out of the hole. So flathead catfish are a preferred fish for that kind of thing.
Now, I would imagine this could be kind of unnerving, because it's worth pointing out that when a catfish opens its mouth wide, its jaws are quite large, and it does have barbed teeth.
Yeah, and some of these fish, I mean, there was a champion catfish caught a couple years ago, it was 111 pounds. They're huge. They can pull you under. And the other thing is that noodlers are frightened of snapping turtles and cottonmouth snakes and all kinds of other things that nest in those same holes.
So you went out noodling yourself?
I did. I went to Arkansas first and hung out with a bunch of Arkansas noodlers, and that was less than successful. So I found this old high school buddy who I'd heard was just a champion noodler, and went out with him and actually caught a 25-pounder on my first try.
What was that like?
It was a little hard to describe because you don't see what's happening. You're sticking your arm into these holes, and then suddenly this enormous muscled gelatinous thing is clamped onto your fingers and onto your arm, and it's thrashing around, and people are screaming, and someone's jamming a rope in your hand and telling you to put it through its gills, and the whole thing is just slightly terrifying, slightly exhilarating, and, you know, it works.
Now, you write about a lot of different Southern pastimes, and another one is squirrel hunting, which I gather is especially big in Kentucky, and you spent some time with a longtime squirrel hunter. Tell me what he was like.
He was an amazing man. He really was. He was not only a great squirrel hunter, but a fabulous thumb-style guitarist. He's from a county in Kentucky where thumb-style picking, like Merle Travis does, was born. And he was also an interesting man because he had kept on hunting these squirrels and eating their brains, even though there was a report in The Lancet, a medical journal, that said that there was a chance that squirrel brains might cause mad cow disease. And this guy basically spent a year worrying about it and then said, you know, forget it. I've been eating this stuff all my life, and I'm going to keep on doing it.
Now, this fellow that you hung out with, Steve Rector, once he shot the squirrels, how did he cook them?
Well, I wouldn't call him a great gourmet, but he had a technique which I guess a lot of squirrel hunters use, which is to coat it in flour. For some reason, he used self-rising flour. I have no idea why. And then fry it in a pan until it's brown. And then he would stick it in a pressure cooker and pressure cook it for about 20 minutes and throw in the stuff he called kitchen bouquet, which people might recognize. It's a brown substance that basically makes things brown and a little salty. And then he would pull it out. And the whole eating of the body, I mean, most of it just looks like chicken, but then you get the head, which really is an extraordinary thing. It looks like a big ant's head. And he would eat the cheeks off of it and pull out the tongue and eat the tongue. And then he would take a teaspoon and lift it up and just snap it very lightly on top of the skull, just like you were cracking a boiled egg, and peel off the skull and pull out this little pink and black brain and just pop that into his mouth.
Is that the great delicacy, the squirrel brain?
It is a great delicacy. I mean, there are people I talk to in Kentucky. You have to remember that squirrel hunting is a huge deal there. I mean, something like 25 million squirrels get killed every year in Kentucky, Ohio, and Illinois alone, and there are about 3 million squirrel hunters. So it's a huge deal, and some of these people really think that the brain is by far the best, and they'll almost only eat that on a squirrel.
Now, there's another Southern pastime that you investigated, cockfighting, which I hadn't realized is still legal in Louisiana.
Legal in Louisiana, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. Oklahoma, actually, it was almost voted out last year, and then the cockfighting lobby, which is pretty powerful, found a little glitch in the way they'd collected petition signatures, and they brought it back up again.
You write about different kinds of battle and cockfights. And some of these knives are actually strapped onto the gamecocks. How does that work?
There's a whole range going from Indians will wrap a foot in it like a boxing glove, and some will just strip the hide off of a spur on a natural chicken's foot. But the more popular fights nowadays, because they're over so quick and you can gamble on them so well, are knife fights that use either 1.5-inch razors, they're called Mexican knives, or 3.5-inch Filipino knives. And some of those in the Philippines are actually forged out of old army bullets.
What's the appeal here, do you think? Why do people like to see these chickens kill each other?
Well, it depends on who's going. I think a lot of it in the small places really is just a sense of community. It's just like going to the high school football game. And in a way, it's all the tighter because it's looked down upon by some people, so it becomes a kind of a secret club. But I think the reason it's popular in the big pits, where you can win as much as $40,000 for having the winning chicken and a new car, is just the gambling aspect. I mean, people come there and bet thousands of dollars on these chickens. And it's, you know, if you like gambling, it's a lot more exciting than watching a slot machine.
Now, it sounds pretty brutal. Is there any effort to justify this sport from an animal rights perspective?
Oh, there's all kinds of wonderful lines of reasoning that the cockfighting lobby has developed, and some of it makes sense in a sense. You know, they'll say, well, you know, a chicken would much rather be a cock chicken, a game cock, than a chicken in a factory. They'll live 2 years on a game cock farm, or at least a year, whereas they'll live 6 weeks in a chicken factory. They'll say chickens kill each other anyway. These roosters are meant for this kind of thing. They're territorial. They're mean. You know, I think the bottom line reasoning is we were given dominion over the animals. It's a religious point which says these are for our use.
And there's one last bit of Southern culture that you write about that I want to ask you about, the roly-holers of Tennessee and Kentucky. Tell me about these guys.
They are probably the most astonishing people I saw on my trips for the book. They're the people who live in just two counties, one in Tennessee and one in Kentucky, and they're the last remnant of a marble-playing tradition that goes back to the Indians or before. And it's a game called Roly Hole, which is played on a big court about 20 feet long with three little indentations on it. And you play in teams of two, kind of making your way back and forth among these holes with your marble. And there's a lot of tactics involved because you have to try and knock the other marbles away from the holes as they're getting closer and so forth. And all that means is that the players, to become good, have to be astonishingly good at hitting accurately from a distance and for putting good spin on the ball, just like you would in pool. Some of these guys would take a half-inch diameter flint marble and could shoot from 25 feet dead on every time with just enough English to make it roll as it bounced, you know, close to the hole next to it.
There's a great story of how two of England's best marble shooters, and it's worth pointing out that marbles are big in England and, in fact, in a lot of countries in Europe, but two of these British marble shooters came over to Tennessee to play a couple of the local roly-holers, and one of them was a 9-year-old kid. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, it was a funny situation because the English had the same kind of tradition that the Kentuckians and Tennesseans had, and they had never been defeated at their game, they said. And the folklorist in Kentucky who read about them in some international marble journal called them up and said, hey, we've got some good players down here. Why don't we come for a tournament and see who can win? And so this pair came of English champions and went to Kentucky at this tournament, and they spent about a weekend playing different versions of different games, and they played roly-hole against the roly-holers, and of course they lost that. But they thought that if they had a chance, it would be playing the English game, which is called ringer, which is a little bit like the standard marble game that we know, because that's their game, and the roly-holers had never played it. And when they picked people out of the hat to see who would face them, their opponents were this guy, Roy Thompson, who hadn't played in a few years, and his 9-year-old son, Nathan, who just looked like nothing. He was this plump little kid, very shy, hardly able to talk. And the English thought, okay, this is going to be a walkover. What they didn't know is that Nathan was just a genius of roly-poly. He's kind of a legend in those counties. From the age of 5 or 6, he'd already been taking guys on in these little parks at night. And he proceeded in the next 20 minutes to just tear through these English guys. They destroyed them like 25-7 or something like that. It was great. One of the great legends of the time.
Now, I understand there's a song that has some connection to the roly-holers. And now you have brought your guitar into the studio, and it's worth pointing out this is strictly a hobby for you, playing singing. But I'm wondering if you could sing a verse.
Sure. This is what this is. I mean, people might recognize this. It's a version of the Battle of New Orleans, a Jimmy Driftwood song that the folklorist in that area, Bob Fulcher, when the English were coming, he rewrote the lyrics to kind of play over the local radio stations to get people all excited about the tournament coming up. In 1991, when the British came across the great Atlantic Ocean just to see who was the boss, with a pocket full of marbles and a little bit of luck, they said they'd whoop old Tennessee and Taylor old Kentuck. We fired our flints and the British fired their tollies. We hit them before they hit us. Fired once more and we gave them such a volley that we busted all their marbles and we left them in the dust.
Burkhardt Bilger writes about roly-holers and other Southerners in Noodling for Flatheads. He talked with Steve Paulson.
He shot and he shot till he wore his knuckle down. Then he kicked the marble with his foot and played another round.
Storyteller Lorraine Johnson Coleman says lots of Northerners have a cockeyed view of the South, the notion that there are black folks and white folks and no one else. So she set out to portray a more complicated South in a book about food. In Larissa's Bread Book, Johnson Coleman writes about the cultural traditions behind various breads, from Cherokee fry breads and Gullah rice muffins to that staple of Southern cooking, cornbread. Anne Strainchamps wanted to know why she picked bread as the subject for her book.
Because bread, the making of bread is so intimate. It's not one of those things like throwing a steak on the grill. When women make bread together, they come into each other's personal space, they talk, they share, they sip coffee while it's baking.
You know, when a lot of people think about the South, I think they think about barbecue, smoked ham, grits. I'm not sure they think about bread.
Oh, the first thing people think of in the South is cornbread. Hush puppies. Bread is the first thing you think. I don't know any Southerner, if you said, name a Southern food that's always on your table, that the first thing out of their mouth would be cornbread or rolls or biscuits. Bread is absolutely the most identifiable food with the South, without question.
One of the points you make in your book is that cooking is about stories and that bread is very much about stories and family memories. So are there family memories or stories for you that come up when you think of cornbread?
Well, if you look at Miss Bess in the first part of the book, she is based on my Aunt Betty. And when I was growing up, my Aunt Betty was the one who often taught me how to cook. And I remember very, very well going into her kitchen as a preteen and her telling me, first of all, that if I couldn't fry chicken and make a pan of cornbread, wouldn't a decent man have me? All the rest of that stuff didn't matter. And she told me that all other stuff fades away, but if you can't feed a man, he won't be around long. So I had to learn how to cook. So she taught me how to cook. And Aunt Betty was like most Southern cooks in that, of course, she didn't measure anything. Most African Americans of her generation didn't read and write very, very well. And so she didn't measure anything. She didn't have anything written down. This was not the Martha Stewart way of cooking. She was very much a sum of this, a little bit of that. And when you say, well, how much is some? Well, some is more than a little, but less than a lot. If she was making a brandy sauce with a bread pudding, she'd say, you put a little brandy in, but not enough to make the preacher drunk. Well, how much does it take to make the preacher drunk? And so you always had all these questions because her definitions were so undefined. But if you followed her around long enough, you learned to cook the way she did, which was learning how the bread dough should feel. Learning how the fried chicken should look right before it's done.
It's pretty different from learning how to cook from recipe books, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And I don't think I've ever seen my Aunt Betty. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen any of the elderly women in my family with a cookbook. I don't ever remember any of them ever even having one. I don't remember seeing one in their homes. It's just something that did not exist in the African-American culture of days gone by. That just didn't happen.
Is the cornbread and biscuits that black folks have traditionally made the same as the cornbread and biscuits baked on the other side of town by the white folks?
Yes, because I always have to teach people throughout the country that only in the Northwest, the Northeast, and probably the Mid-Atlantic is there such a term as soul food. See, in the South, there's no such thing as soul food because white folks in the South understand that everybody eats collard greens, everybody eats barbecue, everybody eats fried chicken, everybody makes cornbread. I mean, we all eat the same food. So in the South, maybe as divided as we've been socially and politically, there is still that disconnect. But in terms of culture, in terms of food, we are very much on one accord. If you go to a barbecue stand and they put out some collard greens and some cornbread, the white folks will knock you over trying to get a good piece of cornbread just like the black folks will. So in the South, food is very much defined by is it good or is it bad, not is it black or is it white.
You also write in the book about a bunch of different cultural traditions.
Absolutely.
Cherokee to Jews in Charleston, mountain mm-hmm. people in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Did you set out to discover, to explore different baking traditions?
Well, no. Actually, I set out to do a book that would really kill the myth that the South is just black and white. We are this homogenous group of people down here, and all white folks are the same, and all black folks are the same. Now, when you go to places like New York City, of course, nobody would even think to say that. There are Irish Americans, there are Italian Americans, there are Jewish Americans. All of those people exist in Chicago, Detroit, New York. Come south, and everybody says, oh, yeah, that's where they have the black folks and the white folks. Well, we also have Irish and Italian and Jewish. And when they came to the South, they didn't leave their cultural selves behind. And what I want to let people know is that those cultures are strong in the South. They have an incredible significance, and these people didn't arrive last week. They've been here for hundreds of years, and it's time they be recognized as the Southerners that they are. And so that's what the book was about. And then bread and food became a great way to tell that story.
So what are some of the other famous breads that you found that you wrote about?
Well, there's fry bread, there's all of the Jewish celebration breads. I mean, I think that many of the Jewish breads are tied to religious ceremonies. But, you know, the wonderful thing was coming up with even new things. I mean, you know, we got a lot of newfangled Southerners here. We got a lot of uppity folks that want to be fancy and Southern. And so for them, I have things like cornbread croutons. You want croutons? We'll give you croutons. But there's nothing like cornbread croutons. So we got stuff for your traditional Southerners, and we got stuff for your up-and-coming uppity Southerners. So we got cornbread croutons. Have you ever had cornbread croutons?
I have never had cornbread croutons.
See?
No.
This is nouveau Southern, I've been told. I went somewhere in Atlanta and had black eyed pea salad. They charged me $9.50 for 4 tablespoons of black eyed peas chilled with some onions on them. I said, what is this? He said, it's nouveau Southern. I thought, and I got to pay this much money for it? So that's when I discovered there was a new kind of Southern cooking that was very fancy. And I decided to include a few of those things like cornbread croutons in my cookbook.
Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Cornbread said, "Now that's all right. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night, and I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night. I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night."
Lorraine Johnson Coleman is a storyteller in Savannah, Georgia. She talked with Ann Strangechamps about Larissa's Bread Book. Coming up, a familiar NPR personality returns to Appalachia.
I have long gone into Appalachia as a reporter. I grew up right on the fringe. Ashland, Kentucky is a steel mill town.
All Things Considered host Noah Adams just ahead. Also, the comeback of Texas singer Steve Earle. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Public Radio International. Noah Adams left Kentucky years ago to work at NPR in Washington, but he keeps going back for a simple reason. He says other reporters aren't exactly clamoring to cover coal miner strikes and other issues that touch Appalachia. Noah has more selfish interests as well, starting with an insatiable hunger to learn more about the area where he grew up. You can see this curiosity in his latest book, Far Appalachia, which sorts out truth from legend in various stories about the region.
Let me start with Daniel Boone. I was surprised in my research to realize, and I probably could have figured this out, and you probably know it, is that he was literate. And he traveled. I have a scene in the book where he is up in the mountains. He was a hunter, loved to be away from his family. There's a story that says that he came back one time, and his wife was pregnant, and he'd been gone a year. And his wife said, "Well, it's your brother. It's your brother's child." And he said, "Well, the more the merrier." And I don't know if that story is true or not, but it is true.
Makes a nice story, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is true. He was literate. He carried Gulliver's Travels with him. And I have a scene in the book where he's way up in the mountains in the snow, and he's roasting a turkey over the fire, and he's got his dog and his horse, and he's reading by the firelight Gulliver's Travels, which, of course, is about this sort of strange travel situation where a fellow is in a country that he doesn't really understand. But that's part of it. It's really amazing to try to put yourself back in that time and figure out who these people were and why they wanted to come. And when they got to North Carolina, preachers back east were saying, "Oh, my dear honeys, Kentucky is a heaven of a place." And the land was supposed to be yours for the asking if you got there first.
Yeah. Now, that's a perfect lead-in to one of the things that you talk about several times in the course of the book, and that's the story of Mary Ingalls, whose family went to Kentucky because the land was free, and you always wonder whether she wishes they'd stayed home.
Mary Draper Ingalls and her husband, William, were the first white couple to be married west of the Alleghenies, and she was kidnapped in a Shawnee raid near the site of what is now present-day Blacksburg, Virginia, and taken up into Ohio near Chillicothe and held hostage, and she managed to escape and then go back in the wintertime, back up the New River Gorge, icy rocks. I mean, it's really forbidding territory to try to travel. And to think that she made it back up what the Shawnee called the War Road in the wintertime, and she was with a woman called the Old Dutch Woman, and things were so desperate that near the end of that journey, the Old Dutch Woman hit her in the head, tried to kill her because she wanted to eat her. They were starving and they had no clothes. And she finally, Mary Draper Ingalls, finally climbs up into her neighbor's field, and her neighbor doesn't recognize her. She convinces the man of who she is and the fact that she has actually been to Ohio, which was the amazing thing.
Now, you talk about her adventure, and at another point, not too far distant from there, you talk about the other great outsider's view of Appalachia that people have from the movie Deliverance. And you went on with this journey of yours. Neither of those is a particularly encouraging story to listen to if you're thinking about going through an adventure like this, is it?
You know, the movie Deliverance did strange things. It set up sort of a dire and desperate view, strangely enough, of West Virginia, even though the book and the movie describe canoeing scenes in North Georgia. I guess because Georgia has Atlanta somehow, and West Virginia has Charleston, which is not as cosmopolitan, not as big. Somehow West Virginia gets hit pretty hard for the Deliverance image. And you can't get into a canoe on the river anymore these days without, you know, it could be a young person who wasn't even born when the movie came out who will start whistling the Dueling Banjos tune, which is actually a pretty good piece of music. But people were vastly affected by that. And the other thing that movie did, after Deliverance came out, a lot of guys just wanted to go out and bang up and down the rivers in canoes and drink. It was an adventurous thing, and that started, in a way, the whitewater rafting industry and a lot of the canoe business up and down the river, as did the Munich Olympics, 72, because we saw for the first time, and I didn't really recall this, whitewater events on television worldwide, whitewater canoeing and whitewater kayaking, and that started the legitimate side of the whitewater adventure sports.
We were talking about the music in Deliverance a little while ago and how it's a very good piece of music. It's actually based, I think, on an English folk tune, but it's a really nice piece of music. Music was one of the things that you found as you went along on this tour. Early on, you went to a town, I don't know how to say the name of the town, but it looks like Galax.
Yeah, it's Galax.
Galax.
Galax in Virginia, and it's the site of the old Fiddler's Convention, and if you want a wonderful weekend, just go down there. I think it's coming up pretty soon. Old-time music and bluegrass, no country music. Well, country music now is simply a pale imitation of the songs that people brought over from Scotland and Ireland and England. And it's just an extraordinary thing. And all these songs scare you when you hear them. And in a way that country music will not. I mean, country music will at most amuse you, I guess, a bit sad. But this is where that music comes from. Songs like Rank Stranger, Everybody I Met Seemed to Be a Rank Stranger, No Mother or Dad, Not a Friend Did I See, I Knew Not Their Names, and I Never Could Find Them. I found they were all rank strangers to me. Songs by the Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe. And, you know, music can just take over your life and your soul. It is amazing. I've gone to old-time music festivals now and seen people play for hours as if they were in a trance. It's like the word rave, you know, we think of something new, but they were doing it back then. And it's all for the player. It's not for the person who would come to watch it. You don't get much from watching it, but you certainly understand what they get from playing it.
Well, a 9-pound hammer,
9-pound hammer,
a little too heavy,
a little too heavy
for my size,
for my size,
for my size. Hold on, buddy,
hold on, buddy,
hunt your horses slow,
hunt your horses slow.
Honey, how can a rope,
how can a rope,
when the wheels won't go?
All Things Considered host Noah Adams is the author of Far Appalachia. It's one of the great mysteries of American history. How did the South, so completely devastated by the Civil War, rise up from the ashes to reestablish white rule? And why did Northerners let it happen? Historian David Blight says it has a lot to do with how both Yankees and Southerners came to remember the war. Blight is the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. He says the war itself had radicalized many Union soldiers.
At the outset of the Civil War, without a question, the vast majority of white Northerners were not willing to accept emancipation as a result of the war. They were not willing to be part of armies and navies that would destroy slavery. But the war itself, in many ways, the scope of it, the scale of the bloodletting and the sacrifice and devastation made many white Northerners into at least anti-slavery advocates.
Now why, though? I can understand that fighting the battles made them feel anger toward their enemy, feel as though they wanted to have some purpose in all of this, but were they so altruistic at this point that they wanted the purpose to be the freedom for Black Southerners?
By and large, it was an altruism. It was a kind of combination of realism and pragmatism. An example, I edited a book of Civil War letters, which were written by a Massachusetts soldier named Charles Harvey Brewster. Brewster was a 27-year-old store clerk in Northampton, Massachusetts when the war broke out. He was as racist as any white Northerner you would ever meet in his language, but he was a very typical Lincoln Republican voter. He went to war in April of 1861, not intending whatsoever that this war would destroy slavery. Then he finds himself on the ground in Virginia in 61 and 62, realizing that in order to defeat the South, in order to defeat its armies, they were going to have to crush Southern society. Brewster sticks it out. Eventually, he even takes a former slave as a personal servant. And before long, he is even advocating emancipation. And by 1864, when his enlistment was up and his regiment was devastated after the Battle of Spotsylvania, he reenlisted to be a recruiter of black troops.
So by the end of the conflict, by the time that Lee surrenders, it's very clear in everybody's mind, at least the people who are fighting, that this has been a war to end slavery and that as a result of the war, the former slaves are going to be freed.
There's no question about that. The vast majority of Northerners who had supported the war actually took pride by 1865 that the Union war effort had destroyed slavery. It became a source of national pride to have destroyed slavery. But the interesting thing about that is that so many Northerners with time came to see that as a sort of permanent deed about which there was nothing more that needed to be done.
And at the same time, then, in the South, you have people whose society was, as you put it, crushed, taken out of existence, wanting it back.
Indeed, they did want it back, and they wanted it back as early as they could get it back. Southern white Democrats, the Democratic Party in the South, gets organized, certainly by the election of 1868, especially by the election of 1872. Some of that organization was, of course, done through the use of terror. The Ku Klux Klan between 1868 and 1871 was an arm of the Democratic Party's redemption, as they called it, of the Southern states. Southerners wanted home rule, and they wanted to turn the clock back if they could, certainly on the question of black suffrage and the political liberties of African Americans. But a lot of what occurs in the South is also a kind of economic revolution. White Southerners want to keep blacks as their labor force, but they want to keep them not as political actors.
What's interesting is that the North was willing eventually to acquiesce in this, to accept the Southern version of what happened during the Civil War, but also that the soldiers who fought, at least if I understand your argument, mm-hmm. began to want to view their enemies as yeah. having been noble warriors yes. engaged in the same sort of honorable yeah. battle that they had been. And to be honest, that makes no sense to me.
Well, that takes a while, Jim. It takes some years before Union and Confederate veterans are able to get together for reunions and clasp hands across the bloody chasm, as the phrase went.
How does it come about, though? How does it get started? Because you'd think that, yes. that the antipathy there would be strong enough to keep them apart forever.
Well, there was a great deal of antipathy, but it begins around the sense of mutual experience, of the mutual sense of suffering that all soldiers face by simply going through combat and going through warfare. Eventually, by the late 1870s and early 1880s, particularly when you reach the 20th anniversary period of the Civil War, every major American magazine and most major American newspapers explicitly recruit ex-soldiers to write about their experiences in a reconciliationist, depoliticized mode.
What happens to what they fought for in the process? In this case, what happens is that emancipation
yeah.
is lost.
Well, it is indeed in many ways. Eventually, soldiers remember and reminisce about their personal experiences. It is the essence of reminiscence. We remember what happened to us. We want to tell the story of our personal sacrifice, our personal suffering. And in many ways, what you find here on a scale like no other American war, frankly, you have a lot of men who feel like they have an experience which has set them apart in society. They saw the war. They campaigned with Grant. They campaigned with Lee. They suffered at Andersonville. They suffered at Camp Douglas. And that experience sets them apart from civilian life. And increasingly, lots of Union veterans by the 1880s and 90s find that they may have as much in common with some Confederate veterans as they do with the new generation of Northerners.
What was the black reaction?
Well, to most African Americans, the whole spirit of early reconciliation and reunion, the honoring of Robert E. Lee when he dies in 1870 as increasingly a national hero already, the use of claims of Southern home rule over against the Reconstruction governments, was devastating. Frederick Douglass, as their leading spokesman, at one point said he was, quote, nauseated by the constant flatteries of Robert E. Lee. It was as though the cause for which the Union had fought and the cause of black freedom was somehow being slowly abandoned in the interest of a reunited country and a kind of new nationalism.
And was he right?
Eventually, in many ways, he was. By the 1890s, and certainly by the time we reached the 50th anniversaries of the Civil War and emancipation, much of the cause, this is the tragedy of this story, much of the cause for which the Union war effort had been fought had been abandoned politically. What you have in America by 1900, and certainly by 1911 to 1915, the semi-centennial of the war, is a kind of racially segregated memory of what the Civil War had been about.
What I'm curious about, again, looking back at this as a historian, do you think that there was a conscious effort to change the memory of the Civil War to one that felt better, that
yeah.
to ignore the issue of slavery entirely?
It's a very good question. How often is the construction of national memory or any kind of group memory a conscious attempt, and how often is it simply a part of a process of history? It's really both, Jim. I'll give you one example. One of the ways that so many white Northerners were drawn in to a Southern vision of the Civil War era was through this image of the faithful slave. Thomas Nelson Page was the best-selling American author by 1890, and story after story after story, where his so-called happy darky would be the narrator of the reunion of North and South, and usually the marriage between a Yankee soldier and a Southern white woman. The narrator's voice in American popular fiction about the Civil War by the 1890s is the voice in dialect of a so-called faithful slave. Now, is that a creation on purpose by Thomas Nelson Page? You bet it is. Are most white Northerners who were buying into it looking consciously for a way to admire the South? No, not always. Some of this occurs, of course, on a kind of subliminal level.
But it occurs to me also, you were talking earlier about the bloody shirt being waved. And in general, that means the bloody garment of a white soldier, Northern or Southern. But
yes,
there were also stories,
yes,
from the black soldiers. There were as many shirts to be waved and,
oh, yes,
as much blood spilled on the ground. But I suppose that people would much rather hear from the faithful slave than from the rebellious slave.
Oh, they would indeed. But there was a black bloody shirt. Blacks begin to have Emancipation Day celebrations as early as 1864. And for decades and decades, and particularly by the 1890s and after the turn of the century, African Americans conducted emancipation exhibitions in towns and cities all over the United States. There were hundreds and hundreds of them. Some of them were big spectacles that went on for 2 weeks at a time. Some of them were just one-day picnics. But African Americans never let the story of the black soldier and the black soldier's sacrifice die in their own community's memories.
David Blight teaches history at Amherst College. His book about Civil War memory is called Race and Reunion. Coming up, Texas singer Steve Earle's odyssey from heroin addict to resurgent country star. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Singer-songwriter Steve Earle is famous for his songs of heartache. He's endured more than his share.
I was born on a rainy day with a dark cloud hanging down low. Now it follows me wherever I go. There were days I swore that I'd blow away with the cold wind chilling my bones. Cause it follows me wherever I go.
Back in the 80s, critics hailed Steve Earle as the next big thing in alternative country music. But just as Earle's career was taking off, a heroin addiction nearly destroyed him. He stopped recording, even wound up in jail, where he managed to get clean. Now in his mid-40s, Earle has been married and divorced 6 times, but musically, he's back on top. He's also published a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses, which happens to feature lots of struggling singers. Steve Paulson asked Earle when he started to write fiction.
There's a story in here called Wheeler County, which I actually began in 89 or 90, thinking it was going to be a novel. And unfortunately, my life was sort of coming apart around that time, and I wasn't even getting my records finished. And I started pawning things, anything that I could fit in my car, to buy drugs, and one of the things I pawned was the computer that story was in, and I never backed it up, so that was lost forever. And then when I decided to start doing this, in about 96 or so, I ended up going to jail, and I got clean, and all of a sudden I had what seemed like a lot of time and energy because I didn't have to find $500 worth of dope every day, and there isn't always a melody lying around, so I decided to reconstruct Wheeler County from memory and discovered that it was only a short story after all. And that sort of began this.
In several of your stories, you get at the tremendous appeal of singer-songwriters. For instance, in your story, Billy the Kid, there's this gifted kid who shows up in Nashville wanting to break in as a singer. And you write, everyone liked Billy. There was something about him that made you want to root for him. When he smiled, and he smiled a lot, he lit up the whole room. Women wanted to take him home and feed him, at least, and men wanted to be him. And I'm wondering from your experience if Billy is a common type of country singer, or is he an exception, almost a kind of a fantasy figure?
Well, I mean, he's an exception. I mean, I think there's a part of Nashville that's always been there and always will be there that's sort of left to center anyway. And so some of it comes from that. And so I've known people like Billy, but for the most part, Billy the Kid is everything that'll never happen in Nashville in a million years happens in that story.
this young, gifted kid who shows up and everyone loves him and he's about
to... completely embraced by the industry and everyone, you know, almost lives happily ever after. Yeah,
it doesn't really work that way.
No, but it should, and I still think it's important to never lose sight of the fact that it should be that way.
I have to ask you about something else from that story, Billy the Kid. Billy is from Texas, and when the locals in Nashville discover this, the first reaction in one of them is, another Texan. And you go on to say he had the hat, the attitude, and the penchant for communicating in analogies. And I had to chuckle because, of course, you are from Texas. And I'm wondering, is that a big part of your identity?
Sure, and it was, especially when, you know, Billy shows up in Nashville in the 70s, which is when I showed up, and that's probably the biggest part of my relationship with Billy is that. We have that in common. The line about Texans communicating in analogies, when I first moved to Nashville, I came on my own first to try to get a job and get set up before I moved my wife up, and I was only 19, and I had a few people that I knew from Texas that were in Nashville, Richard Dobson, who's a great songwriter, and David Olney, and a guy named Gil Francis, and another guy named Joe Lester. We're all roommates, and I had a job, which no one else there did, and because I was working at a pizza place, and so I was readily accepted as a roommate and a comrade. And also, they could call in and order pizzas and not pick them up, and then, you know, I could bring them home from work. But Joe was from Colorado, and people in Colorado kind of hate people from Texas. And, you know, he was always telling me, you know, about, so people, you Texans, you go always going on and on and on about everything you got in Texas. And I said, well, we got everything in Texas, you know. And he was real easy to wind up, you know, because he was sort of one of these people that was wrapped it a little too tight anyway, and sort of voted by his class most likely to end up on top of a tall structure with a high-powered rifle. But he said, well, you haven't got any mountains in Texas. I said, yeah, we do. They're in Colorado. And that's why people in Colorado hate Texans, is because they bought so much real estate in Colorado. And he's the one that said to me that, says, you Texans talk in analogies. You're incapable of explaining or describing anything without saying it's like something else. And he's right. That's the way we talk.
Ask you about your first story, Doghouse Roses, which is about another singer. And as you put it, at age 35, Bobby was somewhat of a cult figure. His records sell well, he's loved by the critics. And then he gets hooked on heroin, he stops recording, and his life generally spirals downward. How autobiographical is that story?
Well, it's the most autobiographical story in the book. You know, I probably had 2 years, maybe going on 3 years clean when I wrote it. So now that I read it now, I've come a long way. I'm a lot different person than I was even when I wrote this story, much less the person that the story is about. But it's going to piss my ex-wife off, I'm sure. But wasn't writing about her. I was writing about me. So her character's probably much more one-dimensional, and because it's a peripheral character when it gets right down to it. She's
She's kind of always chasing after him, and you know, sort of helpless and trying to help him until finally one day she just walks out.
You know, it's no doubt. I've never wondered why she left me. I would have left me too if I could have. I just couldn't figure out. I was trying to, but I would have never gotten clean if she hadn't left me, because as long as she stayed around without intending to, she facilitated what I was doing, simply because as long as she would still speak to me, I figured I was doing okay.
How long had you stopped recording?
I didn't record. I made the hard way in late 89 and released it in 90. And then I didn't record again until I recorded, well, I didn't record an album again until I recorded Train a Comin' in 1995, January of 1995. So, you know, 5 years.
Now, back in the mid-80s, you were billed as the savior of country music, the new voice of alternative country after your album Guitar Town came out. Were those expectations just too tough to handle?
No. I would have been an addict if I'd been a carpenter. I just probably wouldn't have had quite the quality of drugs that I had. But I don't – no, I never – you know, I probably thought I might have, you know, read my own press and believed I was the savior of country music. And then I figured out country music didn't want to be saved and it didn't really need saving. And pretty quickly, I was always pretty well adjusted about who I was artistically and where I was. It was everything that happened after I took the guitar off and walked off stage that was chaotic in my life. I was really good at that and really bad at being a husband and a father and a person.
I'm curious about the liner notes on your album, Transcendental Blues. You say you've spent most of your life avoiding transcendence at all costs because it's just too painful, which is an interesting thing to say for a singer-songwriter.
Well, I mean, I think I spent a lot of my life thinking that the trick was to get as close to the flame as you could get without your wings actually igniting. And, you know, I've learned that sometimes you have to, just go ahead and go through the flame. And that doesn't mean hurting yourself or anybody else. It just means, you know, what addicts do is they don't deal with pain. When I was using, I believed my pain was greater than yours. And I therefore had a sacred right to medicate that pain.
I didn't get in lonely. As blue as blue can be, and just an empty place where your love should be. I'm sick and tired of walking around like this, with my heart outside my skin. I'm scared to death we'll never touch again. It didn't get in lonely.
You've also become quite outspoken on some political issues, especially the death penalty. How did you get involved in that cause?
I'm from Texas, and I was raised in a house in Texas that was opposed to the death penalty, which sounds odd now, but there's, you know, it's not that uncommon. And I've always been a politically active artist. I mean, I don't know. There have always been issues in my songs. I grew up playing in coffee houses because I started really young and I was too young to play in bars, and the Vietnam War was going on, and my politics come from coffee houses in the late 60s and early 70s. And I guess part of it's a recovery thing. When I got clean, I started touring and making records pretty slowly. I mean, I made Train a Comin', which was kind of a low-key record, and I only played 16 or 17 shows to support that record because I wasn't sure how I'd do on the road. And during that tour, I got a call from Tim Robbins, and he was cutting Dead Man Walking and wanted me to see it. And he overnighted me a rough cut and then asked me if I'd like to write something for this record. The proceeds from the record itself benefited an organization called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, which is you know, just words if you let it run by, but think about that. These are murder victims, family members, people who have lost someone that they love to violent crime who opposed the death penalty. And that was a mind-blowing thing for me because I'd always opposed the death penalty, but the argument you always get is, what if it was your son, your daughter, you know, your wife, your husband? And suddenly I had, you know, this answer, this living, breathing answer to that question, that there was another way. And it was a way of dealing with that kind of pain that was much more consistent with my lifestyle, you know, and a form of activism that was much more consistent with my lifestyle. And so I started taking my cues as an activist from those people. It's something that I just can't ignore. I think the things you're supposed to do find you to a certain extent. And there are other issues I'm involved in and other issues I'm concerned about, but I concentrate on the death penalty because the issue seems to have found me, and I think it's what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, outside of my art.
Steve Earle, talking with Steve Paulson. Doghouse Roses is the title of Earle's short story collection. Steve Earle continues to provoke controversy. One of the songs on his upcoming album is a ballad in praise of American Taliban John Walker Lind. On his latest album, he has a song about a death row prisoner he came to know. Jonathan Nobles was executed in 1998. At Nobles' request, Earle witnessed the execution.
I once in mail my letter. Chaplain's waiting by the door. Tonight we cross that yard together. And they can't hurt me anymore. Cause I am going over yonder. Where no ghosts follow me.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Southern Comforts, program number 78A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.